as we demand declassification and accountability, it's fine if the CIA didn't do it. No one, you know, needs that to be true, but there's enough there that these questions and facts have just been brushed over, and it does not follow. And that lack of integrity, transparency, and accountability is what enables future impunity for future crimes. And so as a public, that's where we put our foot down and say, nope, transparency and accountability, we're not letting this go.
Hi, I'm John Kiriakou, and welcome back to Deep Focus. If you are of a certain age, like I am, like our guest today is, you will remember the name Kiki Camarena. Kiki Camarena was an agent of the Drug Enforcement Administration. He was the first DEA agent to be kidnapped and murdered in the line of duty. That happened in Mexico. He was working against something that was then known as the Guadalajara Cartel. This was a very big deal when it happened in the 1980s. And when I say if you are of a certain age, you would remember this, you would remember it because Congress responded to the killing of Kiki Camarena by passing a law allowing U.S. forces, whether they are military, CIA, FBI, or whomever the president deputizes, to cross a border to kidnap a person and to bring him back to the United States to face trial. That is regardless of whether or not the United States and whatever that country happens to be have an extradition treaty. Well, that's what we did to the people accused of killing Kiki Camarena. Not only did some of them get extradited from Mexico, but the United States kidnapped some, including a medical doctor who was accused of keeping Kiki Camarena alive long enough so that he could be tortured more. He ended up taking his case all the way to the Supreme Court. He lost at the Supreme Court, but he ended up not being charged with a crime at the end of the day. Well, the reason we're talking about this now, all these years, 40 plus years after Kiki Camarena was killed, is that there is a body of evidence, increasingly large, that points to the CIA's involvement in Kiki Camarena's killing. Now, we all know now, after all these years, that the CIA, if it wasn't importing cocaine into the United States at the time, it was allowing the importation of cocaine into the United States for the purpose of using that money to fund the Contra rebels in Nicaragua. Congress had barred the U.S. government from funding the rebels, and so President Reagan's people came up with this brilliant plan to sell weapons to the Iranians, have a Saudi cutout, handle that deal on the island of Cyprus, send the money for the weapons to the Saudi cutout, then send the weapons to Nicaragua so they didn't officially come from the U.S. government. And then the CIA then allowed for the importation into the United States of cocaine. The money from the sale of cocaine was used to buy additional weapons from the Saudi cutout. And then everybody was happy until they got caught and nobody was happy. I've said also in the past that if you've ever seen the Netflix series Narcos, very exciting series, very well written, well acted, completely based on fact. You see that the DEA is tracking their man. They're tracking Pablo Escobar. They're tracking the gentlemen of Cali. They're tracking the leaders of the Mexican cartels. And just as they go in, they swoop in for the arrest, the CIA station chief shows up and just screws the entire operation. So why do they do that in Narcos? Well, they do it because it's true in real life. You see, in the 1980s, the CIA cared only about communism, not about drugs. Even if those drugs ended up in the United States, they cared about communism. On my very first day in the CIA, January the 7th, 1990, very first day, stood there, took the oath of office. And then the director of CIA security came in and he told us this. These were his exact words. The gravest threat facing the United States today is the threat of Soviet communism. The Soviet Union was already falling apart. I mean, it was clear even to 25-year-old John that the gravest threat was definitely not Soviet communism. But the CIA really believed that in the 1980s, and at the end of the day, Kiki Camarena was killed. So our guest today is Timothy Kirk. He is a former United States Air Force colonel, and he and his wife currently head a nonprofit aimed at helping recently retired military officials with mental health issues. Tim, good to have you. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you, brother. Glad to be here.
Tim, I've got to just ask you straight out. Why is this newsworthy now?
Well, everything you mentioned about what it was like back in 1985 is absolutely spot on. But there's also the broader cultural aspects to it that are fascinating as well. You mentioned Netflix, and it all goes in kind of a type, whether it's Charlie Wilson's War or American Made or Tom Cruise as Barry Seal. There's kind of this mythos narrative control that has unfolded about the 80s and Iran-Contra and a lot of other aspects of the security situation at the time. And it all kind of fits a type. But where the narrative kind of follows this official line, the facts don't match up with that. So we have a countercultural narrative. On Amazon, there is a series called The Last Narc, which features a bunch of Kiki Camarena's former partners in the DEA, investigators, agents, prosecutors, who all say, hey, the official story is not what the facts bear out. And they bring up a whole bunch of factual basis that's been revealed in court testimony and in official documents that brings a lot of this into question. And that caused a huge controversy with Camarena's former boss, James Kuykendall, who filed a suit to stop the Amazon counter-narrative and then withdrew it with prejudice so he could never bring it back again. No explanation. And Caro Quintero, one of the main figures in Narcos, is currently under indictment in Brooklyn for the murder of Kiki Camarena. That's an active court case. And there are some 30 hours of the audio recording of Kiki Camarena's interrogation and death that are under seal and have been for 40 years. And that has not been made public. So there's a lot to look at in terms of the facts in question, as well as what the government still has. And for the first time this year, the judge ordered that the defense be awarded full access to those audio recordings. So we can look forward to potentially learning more about what's alleged on those tapes. But it's far more sinister than what the Narcos, you know, fairy tale would have us believe. And what's particularly remarkable, you think about examples like Gary Webb, the Kill the Messenger story. You think about this case. There's just a convenient narrative that gets put out into the public consciousness that kind of ameliorates the questions. But under hard scrutiny, it just doesn't add up. And I think that's what's interesting about this. As the tapes potentially come out, we look at what we already do know that's come through declassification. The implications are vast. There's certainly nothing that we can determine in terms of what's true and what's not. But we can certainly make a solid assessment as to whether or not what we're being told is factual.
The CIA is denying adamantly that it had anything to do with Kiki Camarena's kidnapping or death. The CIA also denied adamantly that it had anything to do with the importation of cocaine into the United States. Listen, I'm not the smartest guy in the world, but I do know how to do research. And I did my own research because I was asked to be a script consultant on the Gary Webb film, Kill the Messenger. So I did my own research. And just with what's out there in public, and I don't mean, you know, guys on YouTube saying that there was a conspiracy. I'm talking about actual documentation. It showed that there were two separate groups of Contras. One of them was being aided directly by the United States. The other was being self-financed, self-funded through the sale of cocaine. Well, the cocaine selling Contras were in the south of Nicaragua. The U.S. supported Contras were in the north of Nicaragua, and the cocaine had to go through the U.S. controlled areas to get to the United States. The CIA allowed that to happen. It's documented fact. They allowed it to happen. So when the CIA says, we did not import cocaine in the United States, okay, that's technically true. But you stood by and you allowed the importation of cocaine into the United States. And I'm thinking that the situation with Kiki Camarena is the same. We did not kill Kiki Camarena. No, nobody's accusing you of having killed him. What we're accusing you of is standing by and doing nothing while he was kidnapped or killed, or as some outlets reported or have reported in the interim, supporting the elements, the CIA supporting the elements of the Guadalajara cartel that kidnapped and killed Kiki Camarena. And listen, this isn't just they bundled him into a car and, you know, he happened to die in custody. They drove a piece of rebar through his skull at the end of 30 hours of merciless torture. He gave up, reportedly, everything he had just to save himself, and they killed him anyway. And the CIA apparently played a role in that. Can you comment on those allegations? Is what we're seeing in public true?
Well, certainly not in terms of that manufactured narrative. You can see that the narrative is stylized carefully in a good guys versus bad guys clear line delineation. It's almost Saturday morning cartoon business. The Mexican bad guys are evil. The Americans are good. And Kiki Camarena is out there in front, super guy, Marine, hard charging, and he's going to put a stop to it. And man, he hit him hard and then they hit him back. That's what we're expected to take. And unfortunately, none of the facts make that anywhere close to feasible in terms of the narrative, but you can see how it fits the broader narrative, as we talked about, whether it's Gary Webb, American made, you know, Barry Seal. There's this reinforcing function that appears to be happening within the media. And when it comes to Narcos, the important fact is that was produced over 6 years after Kiki Camarena's partner went public, and Charles Bowden, the investigative reporter, wrote his it was published posthumously how he had investigated this. That had been out for years. So they didn't touch any of that. They didn't acknowledge any of that. And that just makes it harder to buy when it's not objective. There's no even pretense of acknowledging that one of the partner investigators in the DEA has a lot of hard questions and a lot of facts to back that up. Among them, a declassified memo in 2013 shows that the head of the DFS, the Mexican law enforcement agency that was in charge of the operation, was on the CIA's payroll beginning in 1979 and ran through to the end. Now, that right there is a very important fact in considering what influence did the CIA buy with that payroll? What was their directive? What communications are out there? None of that has been made public. So if we are expected to believe this very convenient narrative, there should be supporting documentation of his influence was bought with this. This was our priority. These were our mission type orders. Here's what he was feeding us, the accountability that we're getting for that. In other words, you know better than I do in intelligence, there's a rhyme or reason to influence, and you measure it and you mark what's the return on investment. That's a big, big area of questioning that hasn't even been addressed. And then the development of this fact pattern in terms of the Narcos narrative makes it seem like Kiki Camarena was kind of out there hard charging all on his own, discovers this Buffalo Ranch thing, takes it down almost single-handedly. And because of that, these bad guys got to send a message to those Americans and we're going to take this guy out. Yeah. The facts don't reveal that at all. He was just another part of a broader law enforcement effort led by the Mexicans who took down the big billion-dollar marijuana ranch in Guadalajara. And so it doesn't track that they would target this one American when there's a massive Mexican administration behind the action. Go ahead.
No. Finish your thought.
Well, I was just reflecting that when a cartel gets angry and wants to lay down a hit, we see it. They swack a guy, hang him from a bridge, send a message. As you pointed out, the amount of risk and exposure that it represents to kidnap a DEA agent in Mexico, hold him for weeks, don't just kill him, interrogate him in a disciplined, protocol-based interrogation pattern, which we do know from the tapes, it was that. You bring in a medical doctor to keep him alive while under those torture conditions. And oh, by the way, the autopsy report reveals the injection sites and the dosage of the treatment that they were doing to keep him alive perfectly matches the protocol that the CIA developed in Operation Phoenix in Vietnam. So it's not like normal cartel thuggery. It's very deliberate. And when the other facts begin to emerge about who was in the room, the entire narrative blows up. And the fact that Narcos ignored all of that makes it all too convenient.
Incredible. I want to say just a couple of words about who Kiki Camarena was too. This is a guy, he was born in Mexico, but emigrated with his family to the United States when he was 3 years old. So raised as an American, a proud Mexican American, fluent, of course, native in Spanish and in English. He had a knack for being able to change accents. He had mastered regional Mexican accents. He could immediately jump into a Puerto Rican accent or a Colombian accent. And when the DEA was created in 1973, his sister said, "Hey, you would be good at this kind of thing." So he had been a police officer in the, I think it was in the Inland Empire in Southern California.
Right.
He joined the DEA as a DEA agent. His sister joined as a secretary. They had a brother who was actually a drug addict and who had multiple arrests for drug crimes. So he rose quickly through the ranks at DEA. And DEA was very much like CIA in that if you really want to get promoted, you have to work overseas. You can't just sit at headquarters and expect to get promoted. He volunteered to go to Guadalajara in the early 1970s when there was this thing called a surge. They realized that massive amounts of marijuana were being cultivated outside Guadalajara and they were making their way into California. He volunteered. Now he's a mid-high ranking operative at this point. And he had cultivated several sources of information within the Guadalajara cartel, found a marijuana farm, busted it. It was the biggest one ever busted up to that point. And then he found this bigger one, 2,500 acres of marijuana. Now, it was unusual for kind of a funny reason. It was unusual in that it didn't require any water wells to irrigate the crops. They got enough rain there, I guess, to make it feasible, viable to grow this kind of volume of marijuana. And so he did an overflight with a Mexican with whom he was working. They confirmed that this place existed, and then he set out to lead this raid to take down this even bigger marijuana farm. Okay, with that as background, the Mexican government was corrupt. There were government officials, including police officers, including Mexican drug enforcement officials who were on the payroll of the cartel. He was snatched off the street along with this person, this Mexican that he was working with, who was also killed, the pilot of the plane. And as you said, they held him for weeks. They tortured him mercilessly. And then they drove a piece of rebar through his head and dumped his body and the body of the pilot in plastic on the side of the road so that they would be found. First of all, how is it that the cartel or any cartel could come to a conclusion that they could murder a Drug Enforcement Administration agent and not suffer fallout? Number one. Number two, could it have been that they believed they had some sort of protection inside the U.S. government or the Mexican government, for that matter?
Well, you're hitting on it right there, because just from an operational risk standpoint, you just had your multi-billion dollar marijuana ranch raided by the Mexican authorities and you'd lose it. You're not operating from a position of strength. So if you want to hit back, certainly it makes sense that you're outraged, that you can't let it stand, but you're not operating from the impunity that you once thought you had. So the idea that you're going to go roll a guy up, bring him in, hold him in a safe house for weeks, interrogate him carefully without any protection whatsoever is nonsensical, simply because of the uncertainty created by the shock factor of having lost your major operation from the inside. Your ops are compromised. You don't know who you can trust. You don't know who's feeding information to whom. You just know that you got beat bad. So taking a big risk at that point only ups the stakes and really incurs a massive amount of risk. What's the juice, and is it worth the squeeze? Well, if you think that there's an American who has penetrated your networks and knows where everybody is, sure, that makes sense. But bringing him in under those control conditions in order to interrogate him while you're on the clock, there's a manhunt, they're looking for him, and you've been thoroughly compromised, it seems unlikely that your calculus is, yeah, we've got the impunity to be able to hold this guy and extract all this info without some kind of top cover. And that's what makes the whole involvement of American agencies plausible, simply because normal cartel behavior would not normally follow that calculus. Would they be outraged? Yes. Would they overreact? Yes. But this is careful. This is calculated. This is operational. Bringing in a doctor, following a deliberate interrogation protocol, and you know better than I do that this is tradecraft. It's not something that this was cartels would. Exactly. And so the calculus to do that without some sort of assurances that you'll have the time and space to perform it seems very unlikely, very unlikely.
Before we get to the next segment, I have a lot more questions for you. There's something that you are probably not hearing. While you're distracted by headlines, a real transformation is underway. That is the rise of something called the digital dollar. 134 countries, including the United States, are developing central bank digital currencies. That means your transactions will be tracked, your spending controlled, your savings vulnerable to instant freezing. This is what the current public policy is moving toward. Bureaucrats and those suspicious characters at our nation's three-letter agencies, whom I know so well, would love nothing more than to have more information about you. The government calls it innovation, but let's call it what it is. It's financial surveillance. American Alternative Assets has put together a free guide that shows you how to protect your retirement with physical gold. It's called The Digital Dollar Trap, and it's something every freedom-minded American should read. Inside the free guide, you'll discover how to protect yourself from government overreach with physical assets like gold and silver. So go to johnlovesgold.com right now to get this guide totally free. That's johnlovesgold.com. Because if the dollar is going digital, you need something real. Well, we are speaking with Tim Kirk, a retired Air Force colonel who knows the Kiki Camarena case better than anybody I've met. And I've got a couple of additional questions for you, Tim, because some of this still doesn't make sense to me. Kiki Camarena was just a guy. He was just a guy doing his job. He was good at his job. But the CIA was actively at odds with DEA, not just in Mexico, but in Colombia and elsewhere around Central and South America. So why not sort this out in Washington? so people don't get killed. If the president of the United States is so enraged by this killing that he orders strike forces to begin kidnapping foreign nationals to bring them to the United States for trial, that tells me he didn't know that the CIA had this policy. So how did that play out? And not only how did it play out, was the government able to clean this up at the policy level so that it didn't happen again?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think we have to account for, probably what you and I have both seen frequently, and that is good old classic DC miscalculation. The whole Iran-Contra tin ear within DC comes up over and over and over again. And everything from, the Ollie North congressional testimony on back, the miscalculation steps at times are just absolutely stunning. And in order to really get at the answer to your question, I think we have to consider Felix Rodriguez. This guy has testified before Congress about Iran-Contra. He was really kind of Ollie North's, Central American, Latin American leash. He was the tie-in. He was heavily involved in the Bay of Pigs invasion. He had deep CIA roots within Central America, Latin America operations. And there's just no telling this story without taking a hard look at Felix Rodriguez. And Hector Boreas, Kiki's partner, who makes these insinuations and points out the facts, points hard at Felix Rodriguez as a character that appears on the tapes in the interrogation known as El Cubano, the Cuban. And the allegation is that during Kiki Camarena's interrogation, the effort was clearly guided and led by someone in the room who never speaks, they're never heard audibly, but they're clearly there. And that person known as the Cuban is guiding the interrogation, kind of the process, if you will, being kind of that professional level subject matter expert on where to take it, how to go. And it really looks to me like you have a guy, whether it's Felix Rodriguez or not, it could be anybody associated with another agency's operation. Their sort of myopia that they get on operational impact and loss. They're running a massive logistics effort that spans the globe. It involves Iran, Saudi Arabia, Latin American countries, Central American countries. The scope of that is vast. And so I can definitely see it as plausible, as you're so myopic on how do I achieve operational success, you kind of lose the ball on how's this going to play in Poughkeepsie. If Kiki Camarena just doesn't come home, how does that translate to every night on the nightly news for weeks? How does President Reagan let that impact his priority set? How does this move the funding? How does that move the needle? It's important, I think, to keep in mind that in February 1985, what would eventually happen in the Ollie North congressional testimony was unimaginable. The idea that President Reagan was doing an arms deal with the wicked Iranians using Central American and South American drug cartels to fund it, impossible. That was crazy talk. And I think that lens is important to remember. Now, in the aftermath of Narcos and Gary Webb and everything else, we have an entirely different frame. But I remember being a teenager watching, the clock, round-the-clock coverage of the Ollie North congressional hearings. That was crazy. The idea that Reagan's selling us out and, we're doing this thing with Iran, implausible. And I think that is the important mental framework that they were operating from, that their operational considerations in their mission transcended anything that was possible when it came to blowback at home. Does that answer your question?
It does. I want to read something, and I want to get your reaction to it. In October 2013, two former DEA agents and a pilot who allegedly flew for the CIA claimed to the Mexican journal Proceso that and the U.S. news network Fox News that the CIA had been what they say is complicit in the murder of DEA agent Enrique Kiki Camarena in 1985, and that Felix Rodriguez had played a role. The alleged motive for the crime was that Camarena had supposedly discovered that the U.S. government had collaborated with the Guadalajara cartel in the importation and transfer of drugs from Colombia to the United States via Mexico to use the proceeds to sponsor the Contras in Nicaragua in its war against the Sandinista government. Phil Jordan, a former director of the El Paso Intelligence Center, Hector Bereyes, a former agent of the U.S. Drug Enforcement Administration who directed Operation Leyenda, Operation Legend, to clarify the murder, and Tosh Plumlee, allegedly a former pilot for the CIA, claimed to have evidence that the U.S. government itself ordered the capture and interrogation of Camarena, which then led to his torture and death. Now, Jack Lawn, who used to head the DEA, said that that was so ridiculous that it didn't even meet the worthiness of a response. A CIA spokesman told Fox News, quote, "It's ridiculous to suggest that the CIA had anything to do with the murder of a U.S. federal agent or the escape of his killer." Okay, fine. With that said, let's look at Felix Rodriguez. So Felix Rodriguez, who is still alive, by the way, he's going to be 85 years old in May. Felix Rodriguez was a Cuban who left Cuba when Fidel Castro came to power, along with his family. He was almost immediately recruited by the CIA. He went back to Cuba and infiltrated the Cuban government in the weeks and months before the Bay of Pigs operations. He was a paramilitary operations officer in the Special Activities Division and took part in the Bay of Pigs invasion. He was responsible for the assassination of Che Guevara in Bolivia. And then lo and behold, all those years later, in 1984 and 1985, 1986, he was involved in the Iran-Contra affair, essentially allowing the Nicaraguan Contras to send drugs to the United States. So on the one hand, we know with documentary certainty that Felix Rodriguez was not just associated with the CIA. He went on to become a CIA officer once he got his American citizenship. Not only do we know that Felix Rodriguez was involved in the Bay of Pigs and the killing of Che Guevara and the Iran-Contra affair and the Guadalajara cartel, but now his name comes up in the killing of Camarena. So we've got denials by the CIA. We have a denial by the former head of the DEA. But is it plausible to you that Felix Rodriguez would have been the person in the room? Or if he wasn't, is it plausible to you that Felix Rodriguez would have been the person who might have ordered the abduction of Kiki Camarena?
Well, it's not only plausible, it's backed up by evidence. So another declassified State Department cable that was declassified in 2013 shows that Felix Rodriguez was in Mexico City the very week that Camarena was kidnapped. He was in Mexico City to meet with Caro Quintero, the head of the cartel that captured and interrogated Kiki Camarena. So it is not only feasible, it is established that he is located in Mexico for the purposes of meeting with the guy who has control over the Camarena operation. When you add that to what we already established with the DFS being under the sway of the CIA, it gives you the coordinating authorities there in order to pull that off. Furthermore, it's been declassified through State Department communications that Felix Rodriguez was able to move with impunity through Mexico, El Salvador, and Nicaragua through, you know it better than I do, the special visa type of arrangement system that enables our people to move freely. And so he was able to not only be there that week, he was able to be there as a part of a series of meetings that were taking a place across the theater. So yes, it's absolutely plausible. And if anything, there should be evidence that provides an alibi as to suggest where he actually was, now that we know he was on the ground in Mexico during the event.
So what happens now? I mean, this has been sort of played out in the courts through the 80s and the 90s. We've got a documentary that lays all this out, you know, for the American people to make their own decision. But what about justice? Is there going to be any justice for Kiki Camarena or for his family?
Well, that's the hope. And certainly they deserve that. And that's why it's important that we continue the conversation. The court case on Quintero in Brooklyn is really ground zero moving forward. Now that the judge has granted access to the full audio recordings, or at least the audio recordings that survived, we can talk more about, there's only 33 of the original 45 interrogation tapes that are still in evidence, which, you know, begs questions as well. But those have now been given to the defense. And how that plays out in terms of what's allowed in evidence, what testimony is allowed, and how that moves forward is going to be central to how this ends. Because it's simply impossible to look at what has come out from the tapes back in the early 90s. Everything that was released in the court process in the 90s was carefully cultivated, all, you know, supporting the official narrative, and the defense was not allowed to extract any of their own audio samples for examination. And the evidentiary base was mostly a pro forma process, because the name of the game wasn't justice. It was other aspects of narrative control and stuff like that. And you can see that in how it played out. People going back to Mexico, getting extradited back here, back and forth. No justice ever comes out. You mentioned the doctor, arrested and returned to Mexico, treated as a hero, you know, for standing up to those gringos type of thing.
Yep.
A lot of posturing, a lot of diplomacy involved. But this time we have a chance that this court case, especially as evidenced by the fact that the judge has allowed the defense to have, you know, full run of what's there. I think a campaign of public pressure and demand for declassification and release is absolutely called for, because the American people need to be very interested in this and interested in justice for Kiki Camarena and just to the righteousness of what was really going on. You know, if you talk about Bay of Pigs, if you talk about Operation Condor, if you talk about Operation Gladio, you talk about Operation Phoenix, there's a lot there, and you can't take anyone in isolation. And I think Iran-Contra is just another brick in that wall, that as we demand declassification and accountability, it's fine if the CIA didn't do it. No one, you know, needs that to be true, but there's enough there that these questions and facts have just been brushed over, and it does not follow. And that lack of integrity, transparency, and accountability is what enables future impunity for future crimes. And so as a public, that's where we put our foot down and say, nope, transparency and accountability, we're not letting this go.
Tim, give me your thoughts on the Mexican government. The Mexican government was in up to its neck in Kiki Camarena's kidnapping and murder. That's a matter of public record. And I think every American has just assumed over the years, even if you don't follow the issue, that the Mexican government is infiltrated quite heavily by the cartels. And that's why counter-narcotics cooperation has been as difficult as it's been over the years. Is that better today? Is it different than what it was like in 1985? Or is this something that continues to be a problem in our bilateral relations?
Oh, I definitely think it's a problem, especially with the Trump administration and the things that we're seeing, like in Venezuela. There's a lot of asymmetric dynamic going on that is a huge departure from what's been seen before. I think there was a certain amount of decorum and civility and diplomacy that was at the forefront before, and people are frankly getting dissatisfied with the lack of results. The consequences of drugs in the United States has become so stark in terms of the casualties. It's so much bigger than any war that we've experienced, and the social cost on the streets is so profound that those outcomes, those platitudes, those narratives are no longer satisfactory for the people. And I think the Trump administration has felt a huge impulse to change that in some way. But it's also bad to be naive about who's involved with what. What you mentioned about the Mexican government being involved with Kiki Camarena, again, really casts a lot of doubt on the idea that they would do that unilaterally, because they're playing with fire. You know, the idea of that you're going to kidnap an American DEA agent and interrogate him and then dump him somewhere, doing that unilaterally without any top cover, without any coordination, is just a death wish. And you can understand maybe the cartel guys having an interest in doing that, but the politicians, I that logic doesn't add up. I mean, you know, the CYA dynamic in any government, and in a place like Mexico where the funding is so inextricably tied with DC and those layers of support being bounded over time, that just seems highly implausible. So yeah, I think that accountability has to come into play, not only in what, you know, establishing what happened, but going forward, how do we make international relationships and partnerships that are based on results, that are measurable, and are staked to mutual interests? It's not winners and losers. We got to win together. And that's what was really missing in this. No one could define what winning looked like in Iran-Contra. There was kind of a grand notion that the Sandinistas went away, but that wasn't defined in any measurable terms, and there wasn't an operational matrix that would help evaluate how we were doing there. It was kind of a principled bluster, if you will, very reminiscent of Vietnam. And that sort of thinking is what drove a lot of these bad decisions or bad outcomes, because people weren't thinking in terms of measurable end states. What does it look like? How do we get there? How do we measure it? And instead, it's just like, hey, team, let's go. And that resulted in all kinds of bad outcomes.
So here we are 40 years, more than 40 years now after Kiki Camarena was executed. It's almost quaint to think that this was over weed. And now it's de facto legal all across the United States. I would venture then to say that the situation is worse now than it was in 1985, because we're dealing with the likes of fentanyl. Some of it's made in China and shipped directly to the United States. Some of it's made in China and shipped to Mexico for transshipment to the United States. Some of it's made in Mexico. But either way, fentanyl is such a problem that for three consecutive years, the average lifespan of the average American has fallen because so many young people are dying of fentanyl overdoses, not realizing in most cases that they've ingested fentanyl. What does that mean for U.S. relations with Mexico today? And what does it mean for DEA operations in Mexico today compared to what it was like in the 1980s when Kiki Camarena was in Guadalajara?
Well, if what guys like Hector Bareilles are saying is true, then it's bigger than anyone imagines. The DEA becomes a heat shield, a public posturing to say we're doing something about the war on drugs, we're going to stop it. Even though the plausibility of the United States spends more on national defense than all the other countries of the world combined, and yet we can't stop the flow of illicit narcotics into the United States, we can't even like make it diminish, that boggles all credibility. So I think that's what we really have to deal with first and foremost. We lose all credibility if we look at this problem and don't be realistic about what's going on. There has to be alternate explanations to simply, the cartels have overpowered the U.S. national defense establishment. The United States is completely feckless when it comes to defending its shores against poisonous stuff being brought in that's doing massive economic and humanitarian damage. And we're destined to lose. Can't win, don't try. That doesn't add up and it doesn't make any sense. So once you get to that point, now you have to say, okay, what are the real stakes? What's really going on? What's really being played? Because until you address that, it's just more the same theater. And I think that's really the major implication to all of this is, what if we've been fed theater for so long that we're not even having the appropriate conversation?
Yes.
We're not over the target. And that's what I think is so important about these type of conversations in this work, is to really get back to the core strategic function, the ways and means that are being applied toward what ends, and being realistic about that. Because if we're getting played, then we're just a bunch of chumps and dupes, and we'll continue this ad nauseum and it'll never end.
When do you think this latest lawsuit will finally come to a conclusion?
Well, that's a great question. As all things legal, it depends.
Hard.
As best as I've been able to estimate, we should see progress in 2026. And with any luck, we will see some big events come out of it, especially if we can get public attention and interest driving following the trial. It's entirely possible that we'll get something. But then again, you know, because of the age of the accused and all the players involved, it's entirely possible that the Justice Department will be able to run out the clock. And you got to assume that at some level that is being played, you know, because running out the clock is the way to end game. So that's my concern, is that we will not see significant progress. They'll run out the clock. People will pass away. And then this all passes into legend. And that's why it's important that we're having this conversation now.
Well, I'm glad that we had the chance to discuss this. This is something that, you know, it's one of those things. I was 21 years old at the time that this was happening, and I was deeply interested in it. Not just because, my God, how can a DEA agent be kidnapped off the streets and then murdered so brutally after weeks of torture? But equally interested because of the policy changes that it led to. It led to gringoism, really, is what it comes to, when the FBI can just go across a border and kidnap somebody and bring them back to the United States. It's incredible. But this case, as awful as it is, it also continues to have very long arms. 40 years after the fact, it's still very much relevant. So thank you very much for updating us and for your thoughts and your analysis on this thing. It's very complicated. Appreciate you being with us.
Well, thank you for having me and for your work. I do think it's monumental that we be honest about what if Gary Webb was onto something? What if Barry Seal was more than just a Tom Cruise wildcat yahoo? What if Kiki Camarena was really the product of a bigger machine? And if it all plays together, the implications for the future, it's not just, you know, crazy internet conspiracy stuff. It's real policy considerations.
There
it's
is real documentary evidence to
That's
back
right.
this up.
That's right.
First person documentary evidence.
And it gives us an object lesson going forward for future policymakers to say, look, the interests that drive these bad decisions are acute. They're in your face. There will be voices that will make it make sense and make it seem okay to do. But when you do it, people get hurt. Justice is impugned. The American people are hurt and people die and our society is weakened. And if we can elevate the conversation to be real about those things, do not pursue convenient solutions, but rather be wise in thinking through consequences and being virtuous in your decision making. That's an art that has been absent in DC for I don't know how long. And it's something that I really think we owe it to the American people to get back to. And that's my hope, is that by having these conversations, we can elevate that conversation and get back to a more wise and virtuous policymaking.
Agreed. Agreed. Tim, before I let you go, tell our viewers where they can learn more about the work that you're doing.
Yeah, so I do work day to day on the veteran suicide problem. I served 25 years in the military, many years in combat environments, 3 years in Afghanistan. And, you know, it's kind of interesting. My experience in Afghanistan hauntingly reflects some aspects of the Kiki Camarena case. My best friend, Bruiser Bryant, lost his life along with his 8-man team in Afghanistan because of something remarkably similar with a drug operation. And that is really what hit me and made me take an honest, hard look, because that narrative did not match reality either. I kind of became a Hector Borella's observer in that case. And so I am dedicated on my side time to researching these facts, as you said, the documentable evidence, what is in the record, and recognizing the patterns that flow from these operational things. So I'm on X, Colonel Tim Kirk, and I use a variety of research methods, try to innovate some things in order to give people fresh perspective, and just try to continue the conversation there.
Thanks for everything you're doing, and thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me, brother.
All the best. Folks, I want to thank you again for making Deep Focus what it is today. We just started earlier this year, and we are bumping up against 100,000 subscribers. So thanks. That's all thanks to you. Please do me the kindness of liking, sharing, subscribing, commenting. Remember, if you have a question, just put it in the chat. We answer all the questions, and we look forward to doing that the next time. Until then, I'm John Kiriakou. You've been watching Deep Focus. Take care.